Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, you were born in the heartland, right?
Yeah, Patrick. I would consider Ohio the heartland.
Well, how would you describe the sound of the heartland?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess I would describe it as the sound.
The sound?
Okay. Okay, Patrick, it's fall now. You say it's fall.
Yep.
Right?
And, yes.
And so fall, to me, not only means hopefully nicer weather, you know,
cooler.
Because we get rid of the terrible summer heat and humidity here in the D.C. area, but it also means football in the fall. And I bring this up just really briefly here, because every time we have this patron on, I like to mention the Big Ten, because he's an Illinois guy.
Right.
With us is Eric Lorenz. You went to the University of Illinois, right, Eric?
Correct.
Yeah. And I'm an Indiana guy, and college football's starting, and for the first time ever, well, not that's not entirely true, but for one of the first few times ever in my life, I can be excited about Indiana football. And Eric's team just beat mighty Nebraska. So, you know, good things going here with our team.
Off to a great start.
Yeah. Okay. This show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
This is a patron episode where a listener of the show gets to pick the topic. Eric was just on not too long ago, and we talked about dump truck.
Yep.
And this is kind of a similarly themed episode in which he's going to talk about a band from the 80s. Mm-hmm. That I had not heard before until he brought it to my attention. And I'm very excited about this because this is another one that now I'm really into. So I'll let Eric take it from here.
Okay.
Well, I went back and looked, and sometime in mid-June, at the very end of an episode, Patrick said, "Hey, we should do an episode about the sound." And I had like four sound CDs and one sound LP from my collection. So I thought, I'll be the guy. I want to step up and do the sound.
Because, yes.
I do enjoy their music, and it is in my wheelhouse to talk about these bands, these forgotten bands from a few decades ago. So that's our topic for today.
Great.
It's great. And I think this is a band, based on what Jim just said there, that, you know, he's into them now. This is a band, I think, that's going to hit a lot of people's pleasure center for the Rock in the Suburbs community. So thank you for stepping up, Eric, and doing this. And I'm excited to talk about it because I have a couple stories that relate to record stores and records about the band as well as being a fan. So,
okay. Do we want to hear something first and then kind of get into the history? Let's do that.
Okay.
Eric, what would be a good song that would sort of, you know, define the sound?
How about Winning by from the Lion's Mouth?
Great.
So before you get started here, Eric, telling us about the band, I just want to say that I just, you know, started listening to their stuff in anticipation of recording this episode, and was just really blown away at how good they are. And I know you are a fan of Echo and the Bunnymen. We've talked about that before. So I definitely hear some comparisons there, especially with some of that bass and guitar work. There's I would also compare them to The Cure. And I also think there's even some that bigness of like U2 and The Alarm and bands like that in there too. So am I wrong about any of this?
I think they check a lot of mid 80s and post punk boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. So tell us about the sound.
All right. The Sound is a post punk band loved by critics, but that never sold a lot of units, even in their native England. In the course of researching for this episode, I came across a fitting quote that I couldn't find again when I tried to retrace my steps. And that is, saying that The Sound is underrated is underrated. Anyway, The Sound formed in South London in 1979, shortly after the dissolution of a punk band called The Outsiders. Two members from The Outsiders, guitarist, vocalist, songwriter Adrian Borland, and bassist Graham Bailey, formed the new group with a drummer, Michael Dudley, and a saxophonist, clarinetist, keyboardist, Bi Marshall. I should mention that another former member of The Outsiders, Adrian Jones, continued to collaborate with Adrian Borland and co-write lyrics, although he was never a member of The Sound. The Sound debuted in 1979 with the EP Physical World, released on their manager's label. Also in this time frame, the band recorded some tracks in Adrian Borland's home, with his father acting as the engineer. These recordings were later released in 1999 as the Propaganda album, although some of the songs from that album were re-recorded for other releases during the band's heyday. The Sound's debut album, Jeopardy, was released in November 1990 on the WEA sublabel Corova, which was also home to Echo and the Bunnymen. Jeopardy was recorded inexpensively. It was loved by critics upon release and received five-star reviews from three major UK music publications, NME, Sounds, and Melody Maker. In general, Jeopardy sounds like a blend of Echo and the Bunnymen, as Jim alluded to, and Joy Division, circa Closer. But there are a couple differences, specifically the opening song, I Can't Escape Myself, has a definite motoric beat, which sonically is very reminiscent of Noi, and the use of keyboards on that track and on Missiles reminds me of Pear Ubu. Hmm. Also, one song's Words Fail Me unexpectedly features horns. Highlights from Jeopardy include I Can't Escape Myself, Heartland, Hour of Need, Missiles, Heyday, and Unwritten Law. I would say that Heartland is my favorite of these. And as an aside, there was a recent release, I think either this month or, no, this is in August, by Guardian Singles that did a cover of Heartland.
Hmm, that's right. Yep.
Cool.
That's I think, maybe, Eric, what I was talking about, right? When maybe somebody played a Guardian Singles track or something for new music. I can't remember. Maybe it was me, but I think that may be what it was. So a couple things I'll say here. Corova was a label that Echo and the Bunnymen were selling a lot of records. They were a really, really popular band, and they got sort of this kind of boutique label. I mean, it wasn't like Rolling Stones Records or, you know, anything, or Apple Records, you know, maybe right. In a smaller scale. It was something like that, right? But one thing I always loved about that is Corova is the name from the book and the movie Clockwork Orange of the milk bar where the droogs go, and they're always drinking their milk, you know, they're like milk plus. It's the Corova milk bar. So I always thought that was a really cool English kind of reference. And there's a lot of cool stuff on that label beyond the Echo and the Bunnymen stuff. And I think you said it right, Jim. I mean, I think, and Eric, that Echo and the Bunnymen is probably vocally, also, you know, mainly vocally, a little bit with The Sound is the main reference point here. But there's a whole lot more happening with The Sound than just, you know, a band that was kind of on a label, you know, semi-owned or run by Echo and the Bunnymen, and they put out records around the same time. There's a whole lot more going on with The Sound than, you know, than them just being sort of a, you know, a B team to right. Echo and the Bunnymen or something like that. So yeah, just wanted to get yeah. that out there. And when we get to the next album, I'll tell you a story about how I found out about The Sound.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, right. let's hear a little bit of Heartland. Good. That's very poppy.
Yes. And I will echo Patrick that the sound, I mean, this, you can't really pigeonhole the sound. They
yep.
draw from so many influences and go their own direction in so many ways that they're just unique among, I think, post-punk bands of that era.
Yep. Okay.
All right. Well, after Jeopardy, multi-instrumentalist Bi Marshall left the band and was replaced by Colvin Max Myers, who played keyboards. This lineup worked with producer Hugh Jones on the Sound's second album, From the Lion's Mouth. I had mentioned Hugh Jones in my episode on Dump Truck because he produced the third Dump Truck album for the country.
Oh, okay.
From the Lion's Mouth was released in November 1981, also on Corova. I have to say that if this album had been my introduction to the Sound, it would definitely be my favorite, but my introduction came a little later, and as they say, you always remember your first. So the album also was well received by critics, and Adrian Borland described it as the most polished and probably our most commercial album with some of the greatest songs. While the Echo and the Bunnymen influence remains, I also hear similarities to Simple Minds, pre Don't You Forget About Me. Interestingly, as of 1981, Hugh Jones had engineered three separate albums by Simple Minds. My favorite songs from this album include Winning, which we heard, Sense of Purpose, Judgment, and Silent Air. That being said, there's not a bad song on the album. It's consistently strong, and to me, it's a quintessential post-punk album.
Yeah, good shout on Simple Minds. I thought that same thing. That yep. was another band I thought of when I was listening to the Sound. Yeah,
really great description there, Simple Minds. Yeah, and I'll tell you two other bands. You know, like Eric was saying, there's a lot of influences going on in the Sound, and that makes their music less easy to grasp right away, at least in my opinion, especially some of the tracks as you're getting into the album, because things are packed in pretty densely. And I like that about, you know, music, especially music from this time period where it takes a while for it to unfold. It doesn't like easily show itself, even though it's got some influences. And I love records where it's like, oh, I gotta put all this together. What's the formula? Like, okay, there's a little Simple Minds there, you know, and all these things they were absorbing because they were playing shows and they were a really active band at the time. But I'll tell you my story. There used to be a record store in Maryland, a pretty legendary record store around here called Yesterday and Today Records. It was founded and run by this guy called Skip Groff, who he was very influential in the DC area. He produced early Minor Threat records. He gave a lot of the Discord guys jobs. Ian Mackay, I bought some records from him up there at Yesterday and Today. And he founded Limp Records, which put out the first record by The Raz, which was Tommy Keane's band. So he was pretty popular. So one day I was there, and I think it was like 86 or 87. And I came to the counter with two records, right? One was this album, which I still have, by a band called The Wipers, who were a cool band out of the Northwest, Pacific Northwest. This is the Youth of America album. And then I bought a record. I had to look it up because I no longer have it. It was by a band called The Toiling Midgets. And their record was called Deadbeats. And I don't really remember much about it. But anyway, I brought these two records up to the counter. And one of the clerks there started laughing when I brought up the Toiling Midgets album. And I was at that time a very serious, like, you know, music collector. And I was kind of upset that he was laughing. And he goes to, he says, "Hey, Skip, come here. Somebody's actually buying the Toiling Midgets. Like, I told you, you know, somebody would eventually buy this record." And he was like, maybe they even had a bet. Like, Skip was like, "No one's ever going to buy the Toiling Midgets," or something like that. Anyway, I was feeling kind of defensive about it and a little bit upset. And I think the clerk saw that he kind of hurt my feelings a little bit, you know, by kind of laughing and stuff. So he says to me, "Oh, you know, if you like the Wipers and you like Toiling Midgets, there's a band called The Sound you should really check out." And I didn't have enough money. I mean, you know, it was back in those days. I can buy two records today, right? You know, and I'm gonna look at every single record here, but I'm only gonna buy two no matter what I do, because that's all the money I have. And so I said, "Oh, that, you know, that's cool." And I wrote it down in my little OCD notebook of records to get. And the next time I was there, I bought The Sound. And like Eric, my introduction to the band is this second album, and from the Lion's Mouth album, and just fell in love with it. Of course, later I did something real stupid, and we've all done this. You know, I'm ashamed about it now, but I sold The Sound and the Toiling Midgets. I don't have The Sound or the Toiling Midgets anymore, but I do have the Wipers. You know, and I'm glad I kept the Wipers, but I really should have kept all three of them. It was really stupid, especially when you look on Discogs and see how much copies of The Sound's second album, you know, go for now. So it's going to be one of those painful situations where I have to buy it back, because it was never issued on vinyl in the U.S. I mean, it was a really nice album. And I just had this moment somewhere in the 90s when I thought, you know, CDs are coming back in and all that. And I was never going to, you know, I was going to sell like half these records to make space. And it was really dumb. And I wish I hadn't done it. But now the copies are $40 or $50. But I will say the Wipers is another band that kind of reminds me of what The Sound do. And the other one to me is Magazine.
Which is,
you know, the band Howard Devoto formed when he left the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
And so in a similar way, that Magazine, you know, is kind of related to the Buzzcocks, and The Sound, at least in my mind, is a little bit related to Echo and the Bunnymen. Both those bands are dense, right? And they have that classic, intelligent post-punk sound to them. And their songs, you know, they weren't like Big Country where they really shouted at you, you know, or tried to grab you. Although there was some of that element, the energy and passion in their music. So I think they're a great band. And you know, similar to the Wipers, the bass often takes a melodic role mm-hmm, in the mm-hmm. sound, you know. And I think that's something I've always loved. When, you know, you'll have a little bass hook, similar to Joy Division, right? When yeah. Peter Hook's, you know, would occasionally throw in those melodies and things. But
yeah,
this was my introduction, remains my favorite. And I don't know about you, Eric, but would you recommend people start with From the Lion's Mouth or somewhere else?
Yes, I would. This actually was not my introduction, but...
Oh, I'm sorry. Back,
my introduction came a little later, but yes, if you want to start with The Sound, I would start with From the Lion's Mouth.
Okay, yep. That to me is, I think, the best entryway in there, yeah.
I'll just say real quickly, it's funny you mentioned it, because the bass line being melodic, because that was one of my, you know, one of the things that captured my attention when I was listening to a lot of these songs, and I was thinking, of course, my mind, of course, just like you said, goes right to Joy Division and New Order, because I'm like, that was their hallmark. But I'm like, this band's not quite sad enough to be compared to Joy Division, but it's also not quite happy enough to be compared to New Order. It's like right in the middle, right?
yeah, exactly. And not outright hooky enough to be, you know, on the top of the singles charts or something like that. But there's so much to love about it, you know, and it makes sense too that they were adored by critics and all that stuff. I mean, I think Ira Robbins from Trouser Press had written a thing I saw recently where it was like, oh, without a doubt, one of the top 10 bands of the 80s, you know, guitar band. So that's saying a lot, too. Yeah.
Okay. So we heard the song Winning from this album.
Yep.
Was there anything else you want to say about this album, Eric, or do you want to move on to the next one?
Well, if you want to play something else, I'd suggest Silent Air.
All right. Let's do that.
Mm, great one. Thunder in. For a storm that rears, anger in my heart, a finger on my
what's this troubled world? You showed me that silence can't speak louder than words. Words end in disaster. On the rocks in pieces. I know something lives on there, but I can't say what it is. You showed me that silence.
That's a really, really sort of touching song. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard to awesome stop that tune. One.
Yep, yeah, for sure. Really is.
Well, for The Sound's third album, the label encouraged them to record a more commercially successful album, so naturally they rebelled. The resulting album, All Fall Down, was released in October 1982. It has been called harsh, discordant, and distinctly uncommercial in a history written for the website of Renaissance, a reissue label for The Sound's music in the late 1990s and early to mid-aughts. I had never listened to this album before I started my research for this episode. In preparing for the episode, I have now listened to it a couple times. I was prepared for the worst, but actually, I think this is an album that could really grow on me with repeated listens. All Fall Down marks a definite departure from the direction the band was heading with From the Lion's Mouth. I think The Sound tends more towards the first Joy Division album, Unknown Pleasures, and some of the earlier stuff that appeared on Still rather than Closer. I don't hear any trace of the Simple Minds, but there are some other influences I can't quite put my finger on, and I'll leave that to Patrick. Some highlights for me include Party of the Mind, Where the Love Is, Calling the New Tune, and We Could Go Far with its bass-driven melody. For the most part, All Fall Down was poorly received by the critics. The label was displeased with the album, didn't promote it, and ultimately terminated the Sound's contract.
Yeah, I mean, Party of the Mind is a great song, and I think you said it right, Eric. And to me, this is where some of that wiper stuff comes in. You know, like, I don't know. I always get the feeling when I'm listening to The Sound, and especially this album, of like it always being somewhere where it rained all the time. You know, it was always cloudy. I mean, that's what I think of in the Wipers, right? Being up there in the Northeast and Portland and all that before Portland became, you know, kind of what it is today. But that's kind of the one of the reasons I love The Sound so much is because of that. And it's similar to Magazine too. You know, it's not particularly comfortable at all times to listen to it. And I think that's good. You know, it forces you to be a little bit unsettled. And I'm not surprised that they were dropped by the label after this record, because it isn't particularly open. You know, it takes some work to get in there, but you know, there's so much in music even today that where musicians and songs and bands are like begging you to like them, right? Trying so hard to please you at every single turn. And this band is a feeling of an artist and a bunch of artists and musicians who were just trying to express something that they felt, and they worked really hard at it. And, you know, commercial intentions or success wasn't really something that ever really crossed their mind. And I love that about them too.
Yeah,
I don't think I would have appreciated this album in 1982 when it was released.
Right. But
coming at it now, almost 40 years later, I can really appreciate it.
Yeah, well said.
Okay, where do we go from here?
All right, next is the Shock of Daylight EP. So after being dropped by Corova, the Sound signed with the independent label Static in the UK in 1984. In April 1984, they released an EP, Shock of Daylight, which receives favorable coverage from critics. Shock of Daylight was released in the U.S. on A&M Records, and this became my introduction to the Sound. To me, Shock of Daylight builds on the Sound's second album, From the Lion's Mouth. I hear the same blend of Echo and the Bunnymen and Simple Minds, but with even more confidence than on From the Lion's Mouth. It's a six-song EP, and to me, all six songs are great. The lead-off track, Golden Soldiers, is my favorite of all the Sound songs. And Longest Days, Counting the Days, and Dreams Then Plans are all very strong. I do have a story about this one, similar to Patrick's record store story. This was 1984, and I was in Champaign. I went to a record store. I forget the name. They were on the second floor on Green Street. And the owner of the store was very, very enthused about the sound. Mm. This was right as Shock of Daylight was coming out. And he was the kind of guy who would put little round stickers on an album, and he would write notes about his feelings. He had prominently featured the sound, Shock of Daylight, Jeopardy, and From the Lion's Mouth. And he was ecstatic about all of them, but unfortunately on my student budget at the time, I had to go for the EP of Shock of Daylight and not the imports of Jeopardy and From the Lion's Mouth.
So was this the first one you bought, Eric?
Yes, this was the first one I bought.
Okay, got it.
And it's the only one I own on vinyl. When Renaissance was doing their reissues in the late 90s and early aughts, I came across them online, and I purchased several of the albums on CD, but this was the only one that I owned in vinyl. Golden Soldiers would be the song to play.
All right, let's do that. All right, that's very cool.
That showed up on a couple of my mixtapes from that.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I could see that. Okay.
The Sound's fourth full album, Heads and Hearts, followed in 1985. It was also released on the Static label. I think Heads and Hearts continues in the same direction as Shock of Daylight, although some say the album wears its mid-80s production on its sleeve. The album includes my second favorite Sound song, 1,000 Reasons. Other favorites include Whirlpool, Total Recall, Under You, Restless Me, and Temperature Drop. Overall, I would say this album has more hints of pop than the Sound's prior releases. If I were to rank the Sound's releases, I would place this fourth after Shock of Daylight, From the Lion's Mouth, and Jeopardy. Also in 1985, the Sound released a live album, In the Hot House. I did not listen to that album in preparing for this episode, but I did come across a live performance by the band from 1982 in the Netherlands for the No Nukes movement. And that's worth checking out.
Cool. Are you familiar with this album, Patrick?
I've heard it, just heard it online and streamed it and stuff. You know, for me, the Sound's early stuff is really kind of what I've gravitated toward. And I actually agree with what Eric was saying about the ranking. One thing that's interesting, and I think Eric will probably go into this about the main person, Adrian Borland, and unfortunately met a very tragic end. But he also, you know, was one of these people that was constantly making music. He was in another project called Second Layer that he did with, I think, the bass player from The Sound or somebody. I know he did a collaboration album with Jello Biafra at one point during this time. He was very, very active. He did some producing. And so his mind, at least to me, when I listened to this stuff chronologically, was constantly evolving and constantly changing, just as, you know, the Outsiders were kind of a, I wouldn't say by the numbers, but they were a fairly traditional punk style band. And he moved away from that pretty fast to evolve into The Sound. And The Sound's Sound continued to evolve as well, and this just is like, you know, going in a slightly different direction, at least the way I hear it, and maybe, you know, down the line could have developed into something different. But he had so much going on, and I felt like he's one of these people that was always trying out these impulses and urges, and luckily enough had a way to put that music out for the public. But yeah, not one of their strongest. But you know, that's the case with pretty much everybody with a fairly sizable discography.
Yeah, but it has Eric's, you said, second favorite song in their
catalog,
right?
Yes,
1,000 Reasons.
Yeah,
1,000 Reasons.
All right.
See it crack as it hits the floor. You can't hold on to it and hang on to what you had before. Decisions hang in the air, leave them swinging back.
All right, that's a great tune, Eric.
All right, I would agree with Patrick that the sound's sound was always evolving, and it did follow an arc similar to some of the bands from the 80s with, or late 70s, early 80s, with the first album being kind of lo-fi, the second one being kind of normal levels of production, and then as the production levels increased through the 80s, you know, bands follow that trend for better or worse results.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Well said. Yep.
Okay.
The Sound's fifth and final studio album, Thunder Up, was released at the end of 1987. It was released on the Belgian label, Play It Again, Sam, after the band's previous label, Static, went into bankruptcy. This is another album that I had not heard before I started preparing for this episode. For the most part, I did not find Thunder Up to be as compelling as the Sound's earlier releases. One author wrote that this album, about this album, that the aggression evident on the Sound's earlier releases had largely calmed into a more polished guitar pop. I think that's why I didn't connect, why it didn't connect with me, although the album is a favorite of the band's members. I did like some of the songs, including the more aggressive Kinetic and the songs Iron Years and You've Got Away. I found much of the rest of the album to be too mid-tempo and bland. In any event, the Sound split up in early 1988, not long after Thunder Up was released.
Well said. I'll agree with you on that, Eric. And it's interesting, too, when you look at the Sound as their career, you know, putting it down on, you know, a list on Discogs or however you look at it. There's the early, the first three, you know, Corova albums, and then there's the Static period where, you know, as we were saying, things were kind of changing and evolving, and maybe a little keyboard dominance, a little heavier songs, you know, expanding and evolving, and then finishing up here with Thunder Up. But I will say, for those who really want to get into it, or Scott Parks, there are Edsel Records did a reissue of the first three albums, which were on Corova as a box set of CDs, and then four or five other ones in a five CD box set as well, released only in the UK, unfortunately. But, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Eric, because it says a lot to me when a band gets that extensive reissue treatment, a box set with liner notes and recollections and bonus tracks and all that. You know, for me, I think it's cool and I take an interest in it, but I got to have those original albums to really understand, you know, what was going on. I don't know how you feel about that, Eric, you know, like getting everything from like, you know, an expanded box set with, you know, extra stuff, or going out and getting those original presentations.
I'm more of, as long as I can hear it, I'm good. And as long as it sounds good, I'm good with it.
Okay.
If I had an unlimited budget, then I would track down the original releases.
Yeah.
It's
a good point.
But, you know, and I'm not an audiophile by any stretch of the imagination. So I think that probably goes hand in hand. If you're an audiophile and you have a high-end system, then you probably want to hear the album on the original releases. But I just like to hear the tunes And so that's kind of, that drives my approach.
Got it. Yep. And I think it speaks a lot to the fact that not only Edsel, but there's, you know, some labels here in the U.S. that have gotten, you know, acquired the rights to the sound records and put them out. You know, it says a lot to the influence of the band, the legacy, and the fact that, you know, people care and are moved enough to go to that length and get it, you know, available. There's a strange label called IF53 that reissued a lot of this stuff on CD in 2012, 2013, 14, right around that time. So cool. Very cool.
I think I did see some of that.
Yep, that's out there. I mean, and like you said, Eric, that would be, if I'm going to buy stuff, that would be the way I would go now. unfortunately, and we should say that Adrian Borland passed from the earth. Gosh, he was only, 40 years old, I think, or something like that. He struggled.
In April 1999.
There you go. He struggled with mental health, you know, for a long time. And unfortunately, took his own life, which is really tragic. It would have been, you know, great to have him around and still making music for the last 20 years.
But as Patrick said, he was involved in countless projects. He was always busy doing something.
That's right. And I was just reading here, and I didn't know this, but one of his music creating aliases, it's a really great name, folks. Joaquin Pimento. You gotta love that.
That is great. All right. Any last thoughts on the sound?
I think I put it all out there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Eric. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Eric, so much. So great. Yep.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And anybody out there, I'd love to hear, Stephen Rutledge or anybody, who has memories or had seen the band maybe even, or, you know, any of our European friends who might've come across them, would be awesome to hear.
When did the band break up? The sound?
87, 88.
Yeah, Routledge. Maybe
their last release was 87, Thunder
yeah.
Up.
Yeah.
Routledge. Then, yeah, they broke up early. They broke up early in 88.
Yeah, yeah, Routledge is probably too young for that.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just a lad.
He's a young man. Yeah, he's just a lad.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Eric.
This is great.
We so appreciate it. So we'll talk to you again in, I guess, December. It's already on your calendar. So that's good. And then...
Somebody better put it on mine.
If anyone else, anyone at all, would like to comment on the sound, you can call and leave a message, and we'll play your voice on an upcoming show. The number is 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. I guess that's it. Let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been...
Eric Lorenz.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
We'll talk to you all later. The best thing about all of this is that that he just picked up on some offhand comment that Patrick made, because it was, we all know Patrick can't stop talking.
There are plenty of those, yeah.
And then he's like, I know something about this, and let's make it happen. So thank you, Eric, for that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, great stuff.